Lebanese media: an Iranian tanker carrying fuel to Lebanon has entered Syrian waters. Iran preparing to send two more tankers. EU defense ministers discuss proposals for a European rapid reaction force after the bloc is left on the sidelines during the U.S. evacuation of Afghanistan. New York and New Jersey declaring a state of emergency while record-breaking rains from Tropical Storm Ida kill at least 9 people in the two states. Good day, everyone. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behruz Najafi. Good to have you with us. An Iranian vessel carrying fuel for Lebanon has arrived in Syrian waters. According to Lebanese media, the vessel will offload its cargo at a Syrian port, from which the fuel consignment will be transferred to Lebanon by tankers. Hezbollah resistance movement will donate part of the fuel to government hospitals and some other institutions. Then a private company will be tasked with selling the fuel to private organizations and power-generating bodies. Two more fuel tankers are preparing to depart to help ease Lebanon's fuel shortages. A fourth fuel vessel is likely to leave Iran in the near future. Lebanon is facing fuel shortages, which Hezbollah blames on U.S. sanctions. Correspondent Beirut Mariam Saleh says Iran is sending fuel to Lebanon, and that's a significant and crucial move.
Well, this is a very significant issue. It's not only significant to now fill the fuel shortage in Lebanon, it's also strategically critical, especially since we saw that after the declaration of Hezbollah Secretary General Saeed Hassan Nasrallah saying that there will be shipments of Iran, he said it would be a convoy, not just one single ship. We have several ships coming up. He already declared about three specifically that are ready to reach Lebanon. However, you still have, I think we will be seeing more ships. That in itself triggered a lot of U.S. movement into Lebanon. We have statements by the U.S. ambassador saying that they will be facilitating electricity through from Egyptian gas, through Jordan, through Syria even. They seem to even be willing to break the so-called Caesar Act in order to assist Lebanon in that. We heard also from a congressional delegation in Lebanon just yesterday saying that there is no need for Iranian shipments because the U.S. will get this, will be handling this issue, so on and so forth. They seem to have felt that this would be a very strategic change in Lebanon. Analysts themselves have stressed that this will be very significant. It will be even similar to a victory.
The Islamic Jihad movement says that resistance is the only way to force the Tel Aviv regime to end its atrocities and bullying of the Palestinian people. The movement's spokesman Tariq Salmi warned that cooperation of the Palestinian Authority with the regime won't bring security for Palestinians. He cautioned that such cooperation will only provide a cover for Israel to intensify crimes against Palestinian people and their sanctities. Salmi was referring to the Monday talks between Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and Israel's Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz. The Islamic Jihad also condemned the Wednesday killing of a Palestinian man by Israeli forces, calling it a crime. 39-year-old Raed Rashid was reportedly left to bleed to death after he was shot near the city of Ramallah. Meantime, Palestinians have held a protest in the Gaza Strip to condemn Israel's illegal policies vis-a-vis Palestinian inmates in Israeli jails. Ruba Shafet reports.
Palestinians held a demonstration protesting the Israeli illegal policies against Palestinian detainees inside Israeli jails. The protest aimed at expressing solidarity with Palestinian detainees under hunger strike and demanding the release of Anhar Dik, a Palestinian woman who is expected to give birth in an Israeli jail.
بحضور الفصائل وشرائح.
Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli jails face bad treatment as most of them are detained with no clear charge or trial. Most of the detainees suffer from serious diseases and live in bad health conditions. Amid the medical negligence of the Israeli army, Anhars is in critical condition as she is expected to give birth in a few days. The international community should be held accountable for the fate of Anhar and her baby.
Anhar is also suffering from pregnancy bipolar depression and afraid for her baby's fate in Israeli prison. The family of the pregnant Palestinian woman jailed by Israel appealed for the international community to set her free to give birth outside prison.
We held this rally to highlight the issue of our Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails, especially Anhar al-Deik, who is going to give birth inside Israeli jails. We call on human rights groups to stand up behind Anhar. Palestinian prisoners are suffering from inhuman Israeli policies. There must be a serious action by the world community.
Eight former Palestinian prisoners gave birth to their children inside the Israeli prisons. Statistics say that out of 39 Palestinian women imprisoned in Israeli jails, 12 are mothers.
This rally aims to send a clear message of solidarity to the Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails, especially Anhar al-Deik, who is pregnant and deprived of any medical care. We put the blame on the international community that remains silent in front of these violations against Palestinian detainees.
There are almost 5,000 Palestinian detainees in Israeli jails, including women and children, as well as administrative detainees. Palestinians here demand an end to the Israeli policies and detention against Palestinians, especially pregnant women. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Indian authorities have imposed a lockdown across the disputed Kashmir region following the pre-dawn funeral of pro-independence leader Saeed Ali Gilani. There is communications blockout in Kashmir while more troops have been deployed to the main city of Srinagar to prevent the protests. According to local sources, only a few hundred people were allowed to attend Gilani's burial ceremony. The 92-year-old was the face of the independence movement in Jammu and Kashmir and a campaigner against Indian rule in the Himalayan region. India and Pakistan each control parts of the contested region, but they both claim it in full. Indian-controlled Kashmir is in turmoil. It's been in turmoil since the right-ruling Indian government of Prime Minister Narendra Modi revoked the region's special constitutional status in 2019. Right now, let's see what's going on in Afghanistan. The Taliban are preparing to unveil a new government in the country after taking almost full control of the war-torn country. Taliban official Ahmadullah Motaghi says a ceremony is being prepared at the presidential palace in Kabul. According to local news outlets, an announcement that a new government is imminent. Taliban's top figures, including the supreme leader Haybatullah Akhundzadeh, are also attending the country. The group seized the capital and the rest of the country in a matter of weeks. The U.S. also pulled out its remaining troops before the August 31st deadline, ending its 20-year occupation. Calls are growing in the European Union for the creation of a rapid reaction force after the bloc was recently sidelined by the U.S. in Afghanistan. EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell said the need for more European defense has never been more urgent. Slovenia, which holds the bloc's rotating presidency, says that a rapid response force could consist of 5,000 to 20,000 soldiers. The Slovenian defense minister has called for a new system to allow EU troops dispatched if a majority of member states agree to deployments. Germany has also stressed the need for the EU to become more autonomous.
It is very important that we don't act as an alternative to NATO and the Americans, but to become stronger ourselves.
Now, those comments were made as EU defense ministers met in Slovenia to discuss the fallout of Western forces' rushed withdrawal from Afghanistan. European Council President Charles Michel says that Brussels relied on Washington for the evacuation of its citizens from Kabul. Also, the bloc was not involved when Washington and the Taliban signed a peace deal last year. In 2007, the European Union established a system of battle groups, but a 1,500-strong contingent has never been deployed due to internal disputes. The British Foreign Secretary says that there is a need to engage with the Taliban on Afghanistan.
We are pragmatic and realistic. We don't recognize governments. We will not be recognizing the Taliban, but we do see the need to be able to have direct engagement. Otherwise, we can't provide messages. We can't listen to the response. I think engagement will be important in order to set early tests, and what we'll be judging the Taliban by is their actions, not their words.
Now, Dominic Raab made a comment during a joint press conference with his Qatari counterpart, Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdulrahman Al Thani, in Doha. Raab also stressed the need to hold the Taliban to account under a public pledge of a more inclusive government. The Qatari foreign minister also said that his country is in talks with the Taliban to resume operations at the Kabul airport as soon as possible. The airport was damaged as the U.S. and its allies evacuated their last forces from the country. Meantime, Russia is saying it has no intention to mediate negotiations between the Taliban and other political forces in Afghanistan.
We have long urged the Taliban and other ethnic political groups in Afghanistan to negotiate the creation of an inclusive transitional government. Currently, we have no plans for being a mediator at such talks. As far as I know, nobody else has such plans either.
The Russian foreign minister says that everyone is interested in an agreement between the Taliban and other Afghan ethnical and political groups. Lavrov also noted that the Afghan Tajiks are in talks with Taliban leaders in the Panjshir Valley. He expressed hope that the talks will produce a peaceful solution and the threats of renewed hostilities will not materialize. The Taliban have called on the opposition group in the Panjshir Valley to lay down their arms as fighting continues over control of the mountainous region. Well, as I just mentioned, clashes have erupted between the Taliban and the anti-Taliban opposition group of National Resistance Forces in Afghanistan's Panjshir province. The valley is the only region of Afghanistan that has not been captured by the Taliban following its takeover of the country.
Despite intense negotiations, the Taliban and the National Resistance Front in Panjshir, headed by Ahmed Massoud, have not reached a peace agreement. As a result, the Taliban launched a major offensive from three directions on the valley of Panjshir on Wednesday night to capture an area that has yet to fall under the group's control.
Taliban have had some offensive to the Khawak High Pass from the Andarab Valley of Baghla. From our side, there were local forces of Andhrab, different districts of Andhrab, local forces of Panjshir, as well as the ANSF forces. They have defended very well. They have defeated Taliban on that front. Taliban have lost 40 of their personnel. Another 35 of them were wounded. Four armies of Taliban were destroyed. Two rangers of Taliban were destroyed, and they did not succeed on their offensive.
In the meantime, the Taliban officials say the resistance in Panjshir cannot succeed because the valley is completely surrounded by the Taliban forces. Therefore, the Taliban want Massoud to surrender without any bloodshed, a demand strongly rejected by the resistance in Panjshir.
We want Massoud to surrender. We are all Muslims and we must not kill each other. Panjshir is surrounded by our forces and we will finally capture the valley. So this is better for Massoud to think about the consequences of resisting against us.
Capturing Panjshir Valley in northern Afghanistan has always been considered a big goal for the Taliban, even during their previous rule over 95% of Afghanistan before their collapse in 2001. Ahmad Shah Massoud resisted against major Taliban offensives on Panjshir and did not allow them to enter the valley even once. Now, it remains to be seen if Ahmed Massoud, the son of the legendary Afghan commander, can follow the footsteps of his father, who is also titled as the Afghan national hero in Afghanistan's constitution. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
In capital Kabul, residents are optimistic about the situation in the country after the Taliban took full control of the war-torn country. They say that they have been feeling safe in the capital city as the number of robberies has decreased over the past few days.
Allah has brought peace. There is free movement day and night. The Emirates is good. Earlier, there were thefts of cell phones, robberies. People would do all that. Now no one can steal. You can walk day and night. No one can loot or harm anyone anymore.
The situation is good, thank God. We are poor, underprivileged people, but we are very happy and very thankful. Brother, there is no theft, there is no brutality, nobody can oppress anyone anymore.
A real change has come into the city. The environment and peace is good, but there are issues with wages since no one knows who is running the country. People are unemployed and searching for work.
Well, that was what we had to tell you about Afghanistan. And moving on to other parts of the world, at least 9 people are killed in northeastern U.S. states as the remnants of Hurricane Ida caused record-breaking rains and flooding. 7 people were killed in New York City. Mayor Bill de Blasio declaring a state of emergency there, saying that the city is facing a historic weather event. Nearly all the city's subway lines were suspended on Wednesday night. State of New Jersey has also declared a state of emergency, reporting 2 deaths. At least 5 flash flood emergencies were issued on Wednesday in the Mid-Atlantic and Northeast. Ida made landfall in Louisiana on Sunday. It has since dropped heavy rains and wreaked havoc on its way north. At least 15 people have lost their lives. Millions of people are left without power, with countless homes destroyed. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
Generations of Palestinian children have suffered due to the decades-long occupation of Palestine and the crippling blockade on the Gaza Strip, says Monib Abu Ghazala, writer, in an article titled, Why We Should Not Forget Children of Gaza. Stay tuned for more. Days after ceasefire, Gaza's children are not offered the opportunity to take a break from the trauma and to recover. It has been almost 100 days since a ceasefire was announced by the Israeli regime back in May, and since then, there has been relative peace in Gaza, for now at least. But while the extreme violence has ended, the trauma faced by Palestinians has not. Palestinian children are now facing greater challenges than ever before. Recently, a charity spoke with 10 women and children living in Gaza for its new report, Dreams for Freedom, Stories from the Ground. One of them was 14-year-old Aya, the eldest of four siblings and an aspiring writer. She says the crippling fear she felt about nearby bombs killing her family is permanently etched in her memory. Yet she tried to stay strong for her family. She said, I was very scared, but I didn't want to show it. I took my siblings into the hallway to play with them so they would forget about the war. I tried so hard to hide my fear to the point where I would stand up even when it was dangerous, just to indicate to my siblings that fear is unnecessary and that we should have a strong faith in God. For Aya and others living in Gaza, it is often their faith that helps them through different times. Generations of Palestinian children have suffered due to the decades-long occupation of Palestine by the Israeli regime and the crippling blockade this regime has imposed on the Gaza Strip. For the cycles of violence and trauma to end, the international community must come together to deal with these root causes. With the recent violence and destruction of key infrastructure in the Gaza Strip, Palestinian children are now facing greater challenges than ever before. Of the 253 people killed in Gaza, at least 66 were children. Many children have experienced multiple rounds of violence in their lifetimes and, as a consequence, suffer from anxiety, depression, and the ongoing effects of trauma. About 90% of children and adolescents in Gaza have experienced personal trauma and observed the destruction of property from the Israeli regime bombing campaigns, while more than 80% have been exposed to others experiencing traumatic events. It's not surprising that charity organizations have discovered 38% of young Palestinians are at a tipping point. They admit to having contemplated suicide amid growing desperation stemming from increasingly uninhabitable living conditions imposed by the Zionist regime's 14-year air, sea, and land blockade and several military offensives in the area. Strong psychological support is urgently needed. Even prior to the recent escalation in violence, UNICEF noted that one in every three Palestinian children requires counseling, but there are not nearly enough appropriately qualified professionals in Gaza to meet their needs. While the Western world tells people that the children of Gaza suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, that is PTSD, there is no post to the trauma. Moreover, some of the hospitals and primary healthcare centers where services were being delivered were recently damaged by the Israeli regime bombs. Many children also lost family members and their homes in the recent offensive and are experiencing worsening shortages in water and electricity. In fact, over 77,000 Palestinians have been displaced in the recent rounds of violence, and 100,000 more do not have reliable access to clean water. These crises, along with the increased risk of contamination from leftover explosives, are a huge challenge to the mental and physical well-being of Palestinian youth. While the Western world tells us that the children of Gaza suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, there is no pause to the trauma. Tragically, Palestinian children are not offered the opportunity to take a break from the trauma and to recover. There is only the ongoing trauma that is inflicted by the regular cycle of bombs that are dropped on homes, businesses, and communities. While international humanitarian support is appreciated and crucial, it cannot end there. Countries must use their influence in urging the Zionist regime to end the blockade and the illegal occupation of Palestinian territories, as well as respecting basic universal human rights.
Supplication is the wealth of the believer and the bridge by which one achieves proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Exalted.
A path to salvation, a way to connect the two worlds. On the program, Bridge.
You're listening to the program Bridge on RIB English Radio with Sheikh Al-Musavi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to RIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program Bridge. We are looking at the supplications of Al-Imam Ali ibn Hussein Zainul Abidin alayhi salamullah, and supplication number 8. We're looking at the keywords of the title of this supplication, which is him seeking refuge in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala from bad things, bad morals. So we are stuck at the word morals. We have to keep in mind that bad morals, bad ethics, bad manners are like any other disease, right? It has a reason, or it has an initiation point. It has a cause. No one comes from his mother's womb and says, well, I'm evil. I want to kill people. I want to rob people. I want to do this. No. We said, everyone, the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam says, yuladu ala al-fitra. He's born with innate, clean slate, beautiful, pure, nothing wrong with it. Right? Allah in the Quran, khalaqna al-insana fi ahsani taqwim. We create him in the best of forms. That's how he comes. And then bad manners happen. How does that happen? It's like any other disease, that when I, for example, overeat, I cause myself obesity to begin with, and then with obesity comes a lot of, you know, diabetes and this and that and cancer. All these diseases that we have in the body, they have a cause. They don't happen by themselves. Same thing with bad manners. They have a cause, a reason that brings it up to begin with, and then gets motivated, and then it moves on. And unless me and you are aware of the causes of these things, of these diseases, which is the inner diseases of the soul, we can't control them, or at least we will fall victim to them. And unlike a physical disease, when I, for example, something goes wrong with my body, I feel pain. And pain will indicate to me that there's something wrong. And I take myself and I go to the hospital, and the hospital or the doctor will treat me and will fix it. But when I have a moral disease, when I have bad manners and bad traits and bad ethics, it's very hard to see. It's very hard to see that I have anger problems, for example. It's very hard to see that I have, you know, a backbiting problem. It's very hard to see that I have, you know, envy problem, hasad, and so on and so forth. They become very hard to see. So one needs to be very aware. Now, let us take a break, and then we continue, inshallah.
A path to salvation. A way to connect the two worlds.
The bridge between Allah and His creation.
A bridge that is meant to take us to Allah, to take us to His proximity. A bridge that is in the form of dua and supplication.
In this program, we offer commentary on the du'as of As-Sahifatu Sajjadiyah of Imam Sajjad alayhi salatu wasalam.
The famous book of litanies, the Psalms of Islam.
Bridge.
Rabbana, Rabbana,
welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program Bridge, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. So we said there are causes to bad manners and diseases, just like any other disease that we have. Amongst the causes of diseases, obviously we mentioned a few in the previous episode, I want to mention one more today, is the environment and the society that we live in. Sometimes the society that we live in, we grow up in an environment. You come from a good house, but the environment that you live in, it's a corrupted environment. For example, especially this might be more related to the brothers who live in the West, for example. I go out in the streets, I see women dressed badly. I see billboards with bad images. TV is bad. The school is bad. The system itself is based on corruption. If I live in that kind of system, it will slowly, slowly brush on me. I start to adopt the same ideology, the same methods, the same way of life. And then I end up being a bad person, for example. So it doesn't happen by itself. Obviously, the environment that you live in, it has an effect on me and you. Therefore, we need to be very aware of. Same thing with the society that we grow up in. Because as human beings, in our nature, we are civilized. We like to live among civilization. We don't like to live in villages by ourselves, or, you know, we live away from society in a cave. We like to be civilized. And with that kind of civilization, living amongst people, comes the danger of getting a disease from someone else. In the same way that a person could get a disease from another person if it's contagious. For example, if you go to a friend who has a corona, for example, he will give it to you for sure and he will pass it on. Moral traits and bad manners, sometimes they become like that disease. They could be carried by from one person to another. Another person could contract them easily if he hangs around the wrong people. So one needs to be very aware of his environment and his social arena. Let us take a short break and then we come back.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program Bridge, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. We were talking about how society and environment affects a person to have bad traits and bad akhlaq. Even Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Quran, in Surah Al-Furqan, in chapter Al-Furqan, in verse number 27, he says, يَوْمَ يَعَضُّ الظَّالِمُ عَلَى يَدَيْهِ. There will come a day where the transgressors or the oppressors will bite on their hand and they say what? يَا وَيْلَتِي أو يَا لَيْتَنِي أَتَّخَذْتُ مَعَ الرَّسُولَ سَبِيلًا. I wish I've taken with the Prophet what? Away. And then he says, while beyond to me, I wish I did not take this person as a friend. Why? What's wrong with him? Obviously, because that friend in school, that friend that he hangs around with, be it in his family circle, relatives, or school, or work, these people, they managed to give him the bad traits, and he became amongst them and became one of them. And then he realized how bad that it is. Now he says, well, beyond to me, I wish I never took this person, Fulan. Allah does not name, so it could be anyone. I wish I did not take this guy as a friend. Why? Because he is, Allah says, لَقَدْ أَضَلَّنِي. He made me misguided. He made me go the wrong way. So we need to understand that moral traits and bad ethics, they have a cause and they have an initiation point that we need to be aware of. We'll leave it up to here. And we will continue, inshallah, in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Al-Musawi in the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio.
هرگز نگیرد تا ابد آقا کسی جای تو را هرگز مخواد از کف دهم عشق و تولای تو را
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
For two decades, Americans have told each other one lie after another about the war in Afghanistan. The lies have come from the White House, Congress, the State Department, the Pentagon, and the CIA, as well as from Hollywood, cable news pundits, journalists, and the broader culture, says James Risen, writer, in an article titled, For Two Decades, Americans Told One Lie After Another About What They Were Doing in Afghanistan. Stay tuned, please, for the second part of this article. For 20 years, America essentially ran a narco state in Afghanistan. During the initial invasion and bombing campaign in 2001, the Bush administration ignored the drug problem, believing that it was a distraction from America's main counterterrorism mission, and refused to bomb drug-related facilities. The U.S. spent nearly $9 billion on its token counter-narcotics programs in Afghanistan, yet opium production and heroin smuggling in Afghanistan skyrocketed under the U.S.-backed regime. Afghanistan now produces more than 80% of the world's heroin supply. Afghanistan's opium production soared in 2002 and just kept growing. By 2020, 224,000 hectares of land were under opium poppy cultivation in Afghanistan, compared with 123,000 hectares in 2010, according to the United Nations. The U.S. provided $145 billion over 20 years to rebuild a country that had a gross domestic product of just $19 billion in 2019. As recently as 2018, nearly 80% of Afghan government spending came from Western donors. The combined effects of the massive flows of Western aid dollars funding for combat operations and the river of narco dollars created a surreal economic bubble in Afghanistan. A new Western-style urban professional class sprang up in Kabul, many of whose members are now fleeing the Taliban. But the money also triggered an epidemic of corruption and insider dealing that thoroughly discredited both the Afghan central government and the United States regime. Much of the American money enriched U.S. contractors without ever entering the Afghan economy. Much of it also disappeared into secret bank accounts in Dubai, United Arab Emirates, held by Afghan government officials, warlords, and their families. A phenomenon described in a 2020 report by the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace as the cross-pollination of criminality between Afghanistan and Dubai. Meanwhile, petty corruption, bribes to local officials to obtain any service or job, was endemic, stoking more resentment against the government among average Afghans. The UN found that by 2012, Afghans were paying $3.9 million in bribes per year. Half of all Afghans paid a bribe for a public service. As the U.S.-backed government continued, petty bribery and corruption grew worse, not better. Militias were using their position and closeness with the government and U.S. military to control roads, secure lucrative contracts, establish themselves as regional powers, and sometimes serve both sides, cooperating with both international and Taliban forces to maximize profits, concluded a 2018 report from the Institute of World Politics. The government fueled bribery and corruption forced many Afghans into the arm of the Taliban, who gained the reputation of settling financial and other disputes using more straightforward, if far more brutal, methods. Trying to compete with the Taliban's dispute resolution would have meant allowing laws, and that's not something we could do politically. Barnett Robin, a longtime Afghanistan expert who advised the State Department, told the Special Inspector General. Perhaps the most cynical decision in the war in Afghanistan was taken by Obama in 2009. During the 2008 presidential campaign, Obama sought to distinguish himself from his main political rivals with his emphatic denunciations of the war in Iraq. Fearful of being attacked from the right for being too dovish, Obama balanced his attacks on the Iraq war by claiming that he would do more than the Bush administration had done to win the war in Afghanistan. In 2009, Obama announced that he was escalating U.S. troop levels in Afghanistan, his ill-considered Afghan surge. The surge came with no real long-term strategy, and it is hard not to see Obama's decision as little more than a political calculation to live up to his earlier campaign promise, which had only been made to insulate him from attacks on his position on Iraq. As American troops flowed steadily into Afghanistan in 2009 and 2010, combat operations were focused on the south, notably Helmand province, a stronghold of both the Taliban and opium production. U.S. troop levels peaked at about 100,000 during the surge, the highest levels of the entire war in Afghanistan. But the surge quickly descended into an inconclusive war of attrition. U.S. casualties reached their highest levels of the war during the surge, with fatalities rising to 496 in 2010. Obama drew down U.S. forces to around 8,400 by the time he left office. Donald Trump came into the presidency in 2017, having campaigned on a vow to end America's forever wars. He was determined to withdraw all U.S. troops from Afghanistan, but he was easily distracted by cronies eager to make money. Eric Prince, the infamous founder of Blackwater, nearly convinced Trump to let him take over the entire combat mission in Afghanistan by using paid mercenaries instead of U.S. troops. Instead, Trump got so sidetracked that he let the Pentagon talk him into increasing troop levels at about 14,000 in 2017. Trump finally got his way in February 2020 when the U.S. and the Taliban signed an agreement setting the conditions for a complete withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan by May 1, 2021. After the 2020 presidential election, Acting Defense Secretary Chris Miller announced that U.S. troop levels had been reduced to 2,500. Joe Biden came into office this year, making the case that after 20 years, the war in Afghanistan had to end. Getting out of Afghanistan was perhaps the only issue on which he publicly agreed with Donald Trump. On April 14th, he announced that all U.S. troops would be withdrawn by September 11th, 2021, the 20th anniversary of 9/11. Trump promptly criticized Biden for failing to meet the May 1st deadline he had negotiated with the Taliban, saying that we can and should get out earlier, and that getting out of Afghanistan is a wonderful and positive thing to do. I plan to withdraw on May 1st, and we should keep as close to that schedule as possible, unquote. The Taliban also issued a statement in April criticizing Biden for failing to meet the agreed-upon deadline. They warned ominously that the delay opens the way for the Taliban to take every necessary countermeasure. In an interview with the Special Inspector General, Douglas Liut, who coordinated strategy for Afghanistan at the National Security Council from 2007 to 2013, gave a brief and devastating critique of the American enterprise in Afghanistan. Liut said, "We were devoid of a fundamental understanding of Afghanistan. We didn't know what we were doing." You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters, 7410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent, and FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين السلام عليك يا أبا عبد الله السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته dear listeners welcome to another episode of Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio. Now, some individuals criticize certain, you know, mourning rituals and rites. Yes, some definitely need to be criticized and critiqued and further analyzed. But there are some mourning customs that even the Imams alayhim as-salam promoted. And one of those things that the Imams promoted was the reciting of poetry for the tragedy of Imam al-Husayn alayhim as-salam. And we have traditions that hopefully, inshallah, we'll either mention it or will be mentioned either in this month of Muharram or in another one in the future, that reciting poetry with the intention of making others cry is of great benefit. It's something that is wanted. It is something that, you know, is desirable. So in this tradition, it is reported that one of the companions of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam by the name of Abu Harun, and it is apparent that from this hadith that he was a poet, a person who would recite poetry for Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. For the narration goes that this companion, al-Makfuf, entered into a room where Imam Sadiq alayhi salam was present. So as he entered into the room, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, you know, obviously greeting him and so on and so forth, asked him that, you know, recite for me, you know, recite for me poetry. So the companion, al-Makfuf, recited some poetry. And the Imam says, don't recite poetry like this. Don't, because he probably just recited normal poetry. He says, don't recite poetry like this. Recite for me poetry the way you recite over the grave of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now it is not mentioned in the hadith whether this was during the month of Muharram or outside of the month of Muharram. You know, this is something to understand, that if it's outside of the month of Muharram, then obviously it is something that we can see that this reciting of poetry for Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam is recommended at all times, because this is not mentioned in the tradition. So the Imam then says to this companion, recite for me like you recite over the grave of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, and the companion Abu Makfuf does so. He says, so I recited for the Imam alayhi salam again, but obviously in the manner that I would recite over the grave of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. So here in this tradition we see that the reciting of poetry, the remembering of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, you know, is something that is recommended, and even the Imams alayhi salam would, you know, recommend the companions to do it and even ask the companions to do it in their presence and for them specifically. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to enable us to truly remember Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam and to make us of the